Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for making this your first session of the Bay Area Book Festival. I hope you're excited about this as I am. First, a little bit about me. My name is Alex Brown. I'm a young adult librarian and an author. I'm also a longtime writer and reviewer for Tor.com, speculative fiction, which is actually how I encountered Justina Ireland's lovely books. This morning, it's my privilege and honor to introduce an author of so many amazing things. She's written across the age demographic, from middle grade to young adult to adult, and across the genre spectrum. We'd be here all day if I had to list every single thing that she's written, but I'll tell you my personal favorites, which are Land of Luck, Dread Nation, and two of her short stories, Kissing Sarah Smart and A Theory of Flight. And just announced this morning, in case you have not been on Twitter, she has a brand new Star Wars novel coming out very soon. Please welcome Justina Ireland.
Hey, thank you.
All right, so we'll just jump right into it.
Yeah.
Did you always want to be a writer?
No.
Next question.
This is a question people always ask, and they're always a little scandalized when I say no. But to be honest, I didn't really think it was a thing real people did, because, like, who gets paid to make things up? That's silly. That's ridiculous. That's not like a job. A job is like you go and sit in an office and your boss yells at you for 8 hours because you didn't turn in a report. That's a job. Like, not writing is not. And so I didn't want to be a writer. And then also, I like a lot of kids, I had teachers as I was coming up that did not necessarily foster creativity in a way that made me kind of think I was a terrible writer. I was a kid. I was just telling Alex backstage, I'm the kid who loved to take tests. I love tests. Even now, I'm just like, oh, I'm going to ace this test. Like, when the New York Times puts, like, those tests out, like, how good is your grammar? I'm like, oh, my grammar's excellence. Test me, New York Times. I have things to show you. And so... I had a teacher, I took AP English my senior year, and she gave back one of my papers. I had written an argumentative paper about yellow wallpaper and, like, Ibsen's Dollhouse. Like, you read those things you read in high school that are, like, kind of been read for a million years and don't necessarily apply to your life. And one of the things I wrote is why it didn't apply to my life, and part of it was because I was a black girl, right? So, like, I wouldn't have been the fine lady in the room, like, convalescing after having a child. I would have been the lady, like, picking up the rags after this woman who's going sadly insane, slowly insane. And my teacher wrote this, like, very, just, like, the meanest note ever, which was, like, your arguments are not concrete, and frankly, I'm not really sure. Your writing's not of a quality that basically you should be in this class. And I was kind of crushed. I was like, this. I had worked really hard. I'm also a person who doesn't like to work hard on things because of the inevitable disappointment of when they fail. This was one of the few things in my life where I had, like, taken time and, like, dedicated it. And this was, like, 97. I'm giving my age away now. And, you know, there was no, like, I didn't have, like, ready access to a computer. So I had, like, typed the shit out on, like, my, like, electronic typewriter, which meant I had to, like, go back and redo it, like, 3 times, right? Because I was out of the correction ribbon because this is my life. And I was just, like, crushed. And after that, I was like, I'm never writing again. And so I didn't. But I used to tell stories when I was in the Army. And when you're in the military, a lot of times you spend a lot of time waiting for something to happen, right? There's just a lot of downtime built into that way of life. You're the waiting for your turn for to be, like, you know, some sort of terrible medical experiment, or you're just waiting all the time. And I used to tell stories to everybody around me. And it got to the point where people were like, hey, Mitchell, because I was Mitchell at the time, tell that story you were telling about the platoon sergeant, like, during PT. Like, tell that story. And it got to the point where I became a storyteller through that way. And then eventually, once I've been married for, like, a million years, and once we had a child, I kind of had been married long enough that I knew, like, you lose a certain amount of your identity when you get married because now you're part of a couple. You're now part of a thing. But I didn't want to lose the rest of my identity becoming mom. And so I was like, I have to write a book. That's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to be me by writing a book. And that's how I started writing. So that was a really long story to say, nah, I wasn't always a writer, but I got there.
No worries. We got, like, an hour and 15 minutes to go.
It's so long.
Feel free.
I should probably talk slower. I talk really fast. I was telling Alex, I'm originally from the West Coast, and every time I go somewhere else, they're like, why do you talk so fast? Like, this, what is wrong with you? I'm like, I'm just worried the world's going to end before I get out what I want to say.
We got to get it all out before the next earthquake.
Global warming, earthquake, nuclear, something's going to happen, and I'm not going to get to tell you my thoughts on Supernatural. Hey. So, you know.
Oh, my God.
I'm so glad it's
next
ending.
Next Bay Area Festival. Well, it's going to be you and me talking about Dean and Cass, yes. And that's all we're going to do.
I have so many narrative complaints. So many narrative
Don't
stories.
Even get me started. Speaking of narrative complaints, what is your writing process like?
I use a very complex process known as writing shit down until it works. I'm a pantser. I'm an exploratory writer. I hate outlines. Now, one of the things that's funny is, like, when you start doing work for hire, like, write a Star Wars, you know, people kind of want to know where you're going to do with that story, because, like, having Poe and Finn make out in a middle grade novel is not acceptable.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that is not canon.
Yes.
And so, yeah, so I outline now reluctantly, but I am still an exploratory writer. I like sitting with the characters and figuring out, bless you, what kind of shenanigans I can get them into within the realms of a responsible plot. And I say a responsible plot because I teach creative writing. This is my first semester. I've taught creative writing to undergrads in college, which...
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you. I'm teaching a bunch of classes next fall, too. And one of my favorite things about them is they don't seem to understand how the progression of things, right? So it's like... Sammy and Jane are so in love, and then Jane burns dinner and he murders her. And I was like, what? That's not how it goes, guys. Like, there's got to be some, like the reader has to know things are happening. Like, you know, maybe this is an abusive relationship. We got to lay the groundwork for that kind of thing. And also, like, there's so much women murdered in, like, my undergrads. I'm like, can we have less ladies murdered? Man, the culture. Anyway, so... That was one of the things that I like to do is kind of sit with the characters and, like, what do I not know about these characters that I discover as I write the plot? And there's always something. There's always a lot of nuance. There's always something about the character themselves. Sometimes I'm like, why is this character like this? You know, why are they doing it? And then I'm like, oh, there's some backstory here that I didn't think of because I'm not that smart. And then I have to work on some backstory. See, I really like the exploratory process of writing. However, it does not lend itself to deadlines. Which is a real part of when art and commercial or capitalism meet. If you want to eat, you got to do it on somebody else's timeline. So yeah, so I'm still an exploratory writer of my own things. I've learned to synopsize, because I have to. But I mean, like a lot of things I have to do because I have to. I don't like it. Like taxes, I pay taxes. I don't have because I have to, not because I like it. Although I do like roads.
Roads are nice.
They're nice.
They're a good benefit.
Yeah. Good benefit.
Speaking of Star Wars, so you wrote Lando's Luck, which is wonderful and one of my favorite Star Wars stories of all. Like, I'm going to lump it into the canon of the movies, too. Like,
well, it is canon. It is canon.
Yes.
Everything in the Star Wars universe now or galaxy is canon. So when people are like, I keep telling people, I'm like, look, I'm canon.
Which is so awesome. It's like a story of, like, brown people in space.
Yeah. Just doing brown people things.
Just doing brown people things. I love
it. Smuggling juice. And
yeah.
And hey, if you guys are not familiar with Star Wars, it's this thing in outer space about this empire that kind of comes in and takes over lives.
He's a moisture farmer who gets way too much responsibility.
One minute he's farming moisture, the next thing he's blowing up intergalactic weapons. It's pretty amazing. I'm like, that was also my military career. But no, it's Lando's Luck was one of the joys because Lando is like such a small like side character. He comes in it's episode 4 now, but at the time it was the second movie, and he's kind of like this. Like douchey come on artist who's like, hey there, Leia, you look beautiful today. And he's not doing the soldier shrug, but he might as well be, right?
He's
like Colt 45 and Leia on my lap. And like, and so like, he was just like this one dimensional character. And then they brought him back for Solo, and Donald Glover does such a great job with him. Which I know it's like people are going to come for me on Twitter when I say that, but I love Lando and I love Donald Glover's Lando. Yeah. Because he's a Lando, like Lando in Cloud City is like seen some shit, right? Like he's like been some places and he's like, you know, is mad at Han. And all these things. And like, I love young Lando because like young Lando is like brash and he's like, you know, the galaxy's at his fingertips and he is convinced that with the turn of a card, he plays Sabacc, which is the only card game of the galaxy, apparently. It's not. I've been told many times this is not the only game of the galaxy, but it feels
the only
like
one that ever gets mentioned.
Yeah. But he's like just the ultimate, like, kind of the underdog, right? Because you don't know anything about Lando. We still don't know anything about Lando. We only know that he shows up with, in Solo, he shows up with the Millennium Falcon, which is like the ship. And this best droid, like, where did this droid come from? Like, she's hella smart. She's like an independent droid. So there's like nothing about his backstory, but he's such a great character because he's just so charming. And like, to be able to write a character who is completely reprehensible, but then really, really like fun and charming about it, is like the best.
And to do it as middle grade.
Like, I know. It was really impressive. I was like, all the things I cannot say. I just made a list. Like, I just made a list of scenes I wanted to write about Lando that I could not because it was middle grade. But I think it's like, it's nice to see those characters. Like, I love putting adult characters with child foils, especially middle grade, because I think as we get old, we get bitter. Even if we don't mean to get bitter, we just do, because like, life is life, and it leaves its marks on you. And like, I think it's like, kids' books don't have that bitterness. They're not allowed to, because kids aren't bitter. They don't understand that, like, systems of oppression and things like that, right? It was a lot of fun to write that book, just because I had a lot of freedom, because it's a character that hasn't been explored a lot. And there was some stuff that was, I don't know if you guys know this, but Star Wars kind of like, drew a line in the sand, and they're like, okay, prior to like 2010, these things are canon, everything else doesn't exist, because they had this huge publishing universe during the 90s and 80s in between movies.
Jason.
Yeah. The extended universe.
Google Jason and Star Wars. The whole thing.
Yeah, Google Jason. We do mean Jason from Friday the 13th. Yes, that's the Jason we're referring to. You're like, how do those go together? The internet will let you know. It was the 90s. Things were rough. And so it's kind of cool to be able to say, okay, well, like, these characters that you know, you've known for a very long time, let's put them in a new light. And I always love that. I always like taking a story and reimagining it. I love when people take fairy tales and reimagining them, just because it's stories we know and they're characters we know, but it's just a new way to look at them in an adventure. And that's fun. I like fun.
I don't know how to say no to that. Yes, fun. Fun is great.
No fun.
Fun
is
a good thing. Thank you so much for coming to the Bay Area. So obviously you can't tell us too much about the new Star Wars book that you've got. I'm sure you can give like basic details.
Yes.
It isn't coming out until like October?
It comes out in October. If you guys do not know, October is Star Wars Reads Month. So I always tell people, if you don't know Star Wars books, start with one of the kids' books. They tend to be very welcoming and non-judgmental. A lot of the adult books are actually pretty cool too, because they are standalone stories. They don't rely on your knowledge of the movies or the rest of the canon. Because I know it's easy to get intimidated by a large franchise, because there's so many moving pieces. And then, like, if you mention it on the internet, there's always some rando who's going to pop up and tell you, like, oh, you didn't know that? That happened? And then you're like, I didn't care. I just wanted to. I was just really excited about this book that I was reading, and so I always recommend starting with kids' books, because we're welcoming kids into this galaxy that they've never been explored, and it's fun, and they're quick, right? It's if you pick up like Chuck Wendig's Aftermath, or Alexander Freeman has a really cool premise coming out, it's kind of about PTSD, called Alphabet Squad, comes out I think later this summer. You're gonna it's a lot, right? It's a book. It's a book, right? But a kid's book is like, I mean, when I read it, it's like 30,000 words. It's an afternoon. So it's a great place to get. Plus, you get pictures. Everyone loves pictures.
Annie Wu, her illustrations
yes.
were amazing.
Yes, I have Phil Noto for the new book. So his illustrations are pretty good.
He's
pretty
doing the
good.
Comics, isn't he?
Yeah, he's done some of the comics too. But anyway, the book is called Spark of the Resistance. And it's about what happens in between the last time we saw our characters in The Last Jedi and the upcoming Episode 9 movie, The Rise of Skywalker. Who does that mean? I don't know. Don't ask me. I don't know. I literally do not know. And it's just like this. It's just like an adventure tale. It's like, you know, you have your three heroes. It's Rose Tico, who I actually loved in the last movie, and people hated her unreasonably just because they could. And Rey, and of course Poe Dameron, who is my my galaxy boyfriend, one of my many galaxy boyfriends.
He's my baby.
Yeah.
I just want to like,
there were so many jokes about his hair in the book. I just kept writing lines about my hair. And every single time I wrote it, I was like, can I keep this? And my editor's like, yeah, we'll see why not. So there's like so much discussion about his hair in a middle grade book. It's people are gonna be like, why does she keep talking about his hair? Like, cause it's flawless.
I'm like 90% certain the entire resistance movement spends a majority of their downtime talking about his hair.
I know. Did you see his hair when it came out of the helmet? How does he do that? I don't know. BB, do you know how it happens? And there's your improv for the day. Yeah, and so like it's just wanted to add Ewoks, and they keep telling me no. This is my joke. My running joke is I keep trying to bring in Ewoks through all the books, and they keep telling me no. And at some point, there's going to be Ewoks, and I'm so mad because DJ Daniel Jose Older put an Ewok splicer, which is like a code breaker, in his the Last Shot book, and I was so mad. I was like, how did you get away with an Ewok? This is misogyny. He didn't think it was funny, but yeah, he's very sensitive to those things. But yeah, so it's one of those things. It's like, you know, writing your own stuff is hard and fraught. And so being able to like, kind of put that away and go play in somebody else's sandbox, it's like the best play date ever.
Shifting gears a little bit, queerness. Well, actually, maybe not if we're going to talk about Poe and Ben. queerness does appear in a variety of forms in a lot of the stuff that you write. Why? As a queer person? Well, no. I mean, it's like there's an ongoing discussion of, you know, are you cramming in your diversity into things that doesn't need to be there? And who gets to write diversity and the own voices and all this kind of stuff? You do queerness in a variety of different ways with a variety of different black characters, which I think is really interesting. How do you go about, I don't know, do you decide that a character is queer? Does the character tell you that they're somewhere on the spectrum? Like, how does that kind of come about? How do you explore that? Especially as a pantser.
Yeah. It's a solid blow. Hold on.
Come on, switch.
Can you hear me now? Oh, there it is. Sorry. I have like a death grip. Like my kung fu grip is like killing this microphone. So for me, queerness has always been one of those areas I always felt excluded from, right? So like one of the things about queer identity is you have to kind of claim it. Because if I walk in the room and I don't have anybody with me, right? I'm not like, you know, romantically linked to anybody. That's transparent. But being a woman, that's, you know, it's pretty... For me, it's pretty obvious because I you know, dress how my gender expresses. And then being black is really, really obvious. And sometimes I get, like, people, you know, say Latino, but, you know, they're kind of, like, still on the same, like, axis of oppression, right? Like, we still hate you. And so it's never been something I actually consciously could hide or had to hide. And so most of my coming out experiences, most of my first experiences with women were in the Army, right? And this was the late 90s. This was the time of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So it was always this thing, like, you just didn't talk about. And even when I'm married to a man now, and so even when I met my husband and we were dating, and we would talk about past relationships, I'd always say, like, oh, yeah, I messed around with this girl, and I messed around with that girl. And in his brain, I think messed around was, like, completely different. And so it wasn't until recently when we were talking about queerness, he was like, wait. Because we were in the Army together, so he knows all the people I knew. And so he's like, wait, you did what with who? Wait, let me back up. And it wasn't like a moment of, like, ew. It was like, holy shit, I didn't, like, get that at all. I'm like, yeah, because, like, that wasn't a thing, like, queerness. Like, queerness happens, right? Just like that queerness happens. The end. I don't think anybody is entirely one thing or another. And I think your identity changes and morphs as you get older. I think I'm more comfortable with the way I feel about things and people now than I was when I was 19. And I think that's one of the things that we need to talk about in especially young adult and middle grade fiction, because, you know, my first feelings about girls were in middle school, right? That is the age in which you're trying to look at everybody else. You're looking left, you're looking right, and you're like, oh. Like, you know, you have those feelings for the first time. And like that's one of the things I've always wanted. Like I don't want blackness or queerness or femininity or masculinity to be these other things. I want them to be part of the character, right? Like I want, like that was one of the things. I had a letter from somebody, Jane in Dread Nation's main character, and she's aggressive. She's a girl. She's been taught to kill the dead. Like that is her job. She goes and she kills zombies. She doesn't call them zombies. Because, you know, there hasn't been, like, the Haitian occupancy yet where we have that word in the lexicon. But she you know, she is a militant type of person. And somebody said, like, I bet Jane's and Catherine are going to end up because she's so masculine and Catherine's so feminine. And I'm like, well, but that is not how it works. Like, those, like, you don't have to have the masculine and the feminine. Like, you can have feminine and feminine, right? And so I think it's, like, this idea of just, like, showing people, like the queer, your queerness is valid no matter how it expresses itself. Like if you, like, you know, hook up with one, like, woman in your entire, and then you date only other men, are you no longer bi? I don't think so. I think queerness is valid however it expresses. And that's kind of where I want to get at. It's just another thing. Like, we have no problem saying characters have blue eyes, but we, like, clench up and clutch our pearls or whatever the man equivalent of pearls is, bow tie. Whenever there's, like, somebody, I could just yell at you, right? There we go. And so we tense up whenever, like, queerness tends to come on the page. And, like, I think that we need to get past that, right? Like, so this is my whole thing is, I'm a big fan. Yeah, it's just mostly on. We'll just share them, like, I think it's the battery might is be it low. Just... You try it. Maybe it's just me. What's red? Is it still red?
It's still red.
I think the battery's dying on that one. Yeah. Sorry. I have a failure at the microphone. I just sucked all the energy out of it. No, and so, like, I think one of those things we need to get through, we need to get past these ideas of, like, we can't talk about race, we can't talk about queerness, we can't talk about gender, we can't talk about the spectrum of gender that people... want to inhabit or choose to inhabit or feel like they actually, you know, intrinsically inhabit, because we're so scared. And I think when we're scared of something, we tend to make it a villain, right? We tend to vilify things that we're terrified of. Like, nobody likes spiders. I love spiders. But as soon as you, like, see a spider, people are like, it's probably a black widow, which is, like, the worst spider there is. Unless you live on the East Coast, it is a brown recluse. And then I'm like, man, it's just a freaking, like, grass spider. Like, let it live its life, man. And I think that's, yeah. You're like, I'm pushing the deadly spider narrative. I think that's one of the things we have. Like, we have to counter toxic narratives with our own narratives. And that's the only way we're going to get better as a society and as people, is by understanding, like, these stories exist, and there are these stereotypes out there. And sometimes those stereotypes come from a grain of uncomfortable truth, but most of the time it's just fear. And it's just the people using fear and weaponizing that fear so that you'll come along on the journey with them. And I think that's really why everything is just always kind of just, like, slid in there. Because I'm like, yeah, she likes to make out with girls, whatever, next scene. And I think it's like with Kissing Sarah Smart, I wanted to have just a really nice... It's still on. I thought for a minute I turned it off. I was like, oh, no. Black girls don't get to have, like, nice summer stories, right? Like, when I was growing up in the 80s, which was also a terrible decade, there were so many of these young romance books. So, like, there was, like, always, like, this white girl with, like, this hair flip and, like, this... A white kid with Ken hair. Like, I don't understand why everyone in the 80s had that haircut. It was the worst haircut.
It became the Caesar cut, which was...
Oh, my God, I forgot about the Caesar. Yes. Damn you for bringing it back.
Every white boy in my school for the entirety Caesar. Of the 90s.
I know. It's so bad. The mullet's coming back, too, now. Sorry, it's part of a sidetrack. I'm so sorry. But, like, I had a kid walk in my class, and I was like, he has a mullet.
The and mullet, like, and the fanny pack.
Yeah.
It's like...
I was like, did you do that? You did that on purpose. So, people have choices. They're allowed to make those choices. And we're allowed to silently judge them. But no, I just think that's... Yeah. Like, I always get like, tripped up in the queerness question, because I think there are so many people who want to own queerness. And that's fine. But I don't think it invalidates anybody who's just going to quietly sit there and be queer. Right? Like, I don't know if you guys, I'm sure you guys have all watched those, the Hannah Gadsby thing. She's like, where are the quiet queers? Just sitting a cup of tea, drinking at home, drinking a cup of tea. I was like, yeah. I was like, why can't we, like, we don't have to have the one narrative. And I think that's also a dangerous thing is like, we get into our cultural in-groups and we want to have the one narrative. And we don't want to have the one narrative, right? We want to tell our own stories. But then when we tell our own stories, we only want everybody to tell that one narrative that we all accepted on, right? So like, well, we all decided that Susan was a bitch. Why are you saying Susan's not a bitch? And so it's, you're like, but Susan, sorry, Susan, but you trifling.
I know what, you're not wrong.
Yeah. And so like, Susan, the most hated name in the world. Mine's always Sharon. Okay, Sharon. But yeah, so I think that's one of the things that's it's fraught right now because like you're not writing your own stories. You're writing, like, especially when you come from a marginalized group, you're not writing just your story. You're just writing the story of everyone else who didn't get a chance to write their story yet. And I do not want to speak for all Black people because I'm going to mess it up. I can already tell you, I'm not going to do it right. You're not going to like it. You're going to be like, I got this wrong, I got that wrong. But I also don't want you in my kitchen telling me how to cook necessarily, right? Like, obviously, I don't want to blow up my kitchen, right? Like, if it's something that's very, like harmful, I hopefully I'll catch that before it gets, you know, to publication. But I think it's hard to write in a time where everyone's so hungry for representation and there's so little of it that we're, like, squabbling over the breadcrumbs. So we end up, you know, kind of killing our own, right? Be your own folk. That's why I have something my godmother used to always say. It be your own folk. And I didn't know what it meant. My mom was white, my dad was Black, and my godmother was Black. And she was like the first Black lady I'd ever met. She was like from Louisiana, and she had this accent that came out whenever she got mad. And I just remember her saying that. I was like, what is she talking about? And she's right. Be your own folk.
Skin folk aren't always your kin folk. I think what I appreciated, especially about Kissing Sarah Smart and both Jane and Catherine, sorry, minor spoilers, in Dread Nation, was there wasn't that coming out. And I get it. There's we need coming out stories for young adult, but a majority of my existence, like, I had the one coming out moment where you tell your parents and you sit down, but, like, I come out every day. Right? I come out, like, 30, I'm coming out right now. Hi, how you doing? And I'm coming out as Ace Arrow, which is even less represented. You know how few Ace Arrow people there are in fiction and written by actual Ace Arrow people? Like,
not mine, because that's not my identity. And that was one of the things people, you know, like, I get a lot of people come out. Catherine, the character in secondary character in Dread Nation, is Ace Arrow. Like, she, like, I, like, made a, like, as I was writing her, I was like, you know, like, I, like, she has to have, she's not just this way for a reason. Like, she's very driven and she's very dedicated, but, like, she's very also not interested in any kind of physical or romantic encounter. And she, that's the opposite of Jane, right? She's really on the page because she's Jane's foil. She's opposite of Jane in every single way, except they can agree on, like, certain things. And Jane basically lusts after everyone. She's just like, that's hot, that's hot. I'll get a piece of that too. Because that's the girl I was when I was in high school. Like, people are always like, did you write yourself? I did not, but I was the girl who thought people were hot and would like a slice of that. And that was like a lot of my friends as well, right? And a lot of teenage girls, they suppress that. They don't talk about it in public or anything else, but they do talk about it with their friends. And so one of the things that I think is like, it's like kind of upsetting, and I'm like I try to, like, it's make it about me, but it's not really about me, is when I get a lot of folks who come up here like, I've never seen an Ace Arrow character in fiction before, thank you for that. And I was like, you shouldn't have to thank me for that. Like, that's, this whole conversation is wrong. Like, did you enjoy the rest of the book? Yes, I'm glad you enjoyed the book, but, like, go write your own Ace Arrow character now, because I don't want to be that for Ace Arrow folks, because I'm going to get it wrong. There's going to be something in there people are gonna be like, that's not right. I'm like, yeah, I know it's not right, because that's not me. Like, I'm going off of the stuff I've read from other people. And so I think that's, like, it's important to also understand, like, where your limits are when you're writing those representations. I do think it's important to have more voices in the conversation, and that's really, like, where I'm at. I want more people to come and talk, because I don't want to have to talk and tell everybody's story, because I'm tired. I don't have time.
Well, you definitely told Catherine's story well. It was interesting, the sort of the discussion that was coming out. I read a lot of reviews afterwards sort of about queerness in Dread Nation. And one of the things that struck me, so as I was reading the book, I was kind of, like, pretty early on, I was like, I wonder if she's on the ace spectrum. Like, there were little things that I was picking up where I was like, oh, yeah, that sounds familiar. That sounds familiar. And then, you know, she has her moment. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, that totally makes sense. And then there were a lot of, so if you don't know the terminology,
the opposite of asexual is allosexual. So most of you are allosexual. You didn't know that. Welcome to the world. And a lot of allosexuals were very like, she's ace, but she can't be. She's been flirting and all this stuff. I was like, you clearly don't talk to enough ace people. You don't know how this works. But I think it was an interesting moment where, like, straight people have had that. We're like, what do you mean a character's queer? But I like this character, and I want them to do this. And all of a sudden, allosexuals were getting this. And it's like, hi, welcome to my isolated world. So I think it was an interesting, it was an interesting conversation to watch as an ace person.
Yeah, because people are terrible, right?
People are terrible.
That's where we keep coming back to. Thank you for coming to my talk. People are terrible. And I think that's part of the thing that annoys me about the conversations around queerness and characters, because as soon as there's this theory that once a character is queer, they're automatically not for you. But that's not true. Like, I'm not a dude, and I read lots of dude books, right? It's like, obviously I read more than I wanted to because that was the only thing we were offered, except for the freaking yellow wallpaper. I hate that story so much. I have some baggage about it.
Not as much as I hate the Scarlet Letter. Oh, my God.
I hate that book. I do hate it. Oh, Hester Prynne. She was done wrong, man.
Like, so wrong.
And, like, there was no sexiness from that pastor. It was not like the Thornbirds, right? Like, it was like, God, Hester.
Only paper. I almost failed that English class. Like, yeah. I would not rewrite my paper. And my teacher was like,
but to be, she's okay. Yeah. To be fair, if you've ever been to New England in the winter, you understand why Hester did it. Because it's cold. But yeah, no, and I think that's one of my things, like, I get about, like, I don't want to get involved in the conversations about queerness because there's no winning, right? Nobody wins the oppression Olympics. We're all oppressed and now we're just mad at each other. I just don't want to get involved with those things anymore. I just don't have time. That's one of the things, like, you know, Toni Morrison has that famous quote about racism steals your time and your effort and your energy, but so do a lot of these conversations about, justifying our existence. And, like, I don't want to have to argue to justify my existence anymore. I'm going to show up and you're going to accept it. And then you can either buy my books or you can not buy my books. And if nobody buys my books after enough time, I will go away. Right. And that's really how it works. Like, that's how it works. So yeah. So, like, I do hate that people get, like, into these, I think it's like, just enjoy the art, man. Enjoy the art. If you want to go away and talk about it, that's cool. Don't loop me in. 'Cause I don't care.
You don't want people to at you?
I hate it. Look, I love that people are so excited. But it's really, when you add an author, just keep in mind, they haven't written that book for 2 years. And so I get emails where people ask me questions about something that happened in the book, and I don't know. Because I don't remember. Because it was 2016 and everything caught on fire after that, right? So, like, I wrote that book before we had the Orange Wonder in office. And, like, I can honestly say that all seems like a brilliant dream.
There's the before.
There's the before.
And the now.
And then there's just, like, this is fine. Everything is fine. Flames everywhere. So, like, I don't know. And, like, people ask me about the new book, and, like, it's still in drafts, right? So we're still revising things. And there's really only definite thing I can say is Jane's there. Catherine's there. That's it. That's what we know. Check. Things happen.
There are zombies, although they're not called zombies.
They're not zombies, they're shamblers, yes.
And it's still set in an alternate America.
Yes, yes. It's still that time period.
Put that up on Goodreads.
That's it. That's the synopsis, guys. Yeah, and so, like, I know, it's like, I hate, because, like, you know, like, I had a question. I did a reading a couple weeks ago, and it was this very excited high school teacher who was there who, like, loved the book. And I was like, I'm glad you loved the book. That's awesome. And she's like, how do you want your book taught? And I was like, what? And, like, I had, like, for a moment, I, like, had that panic moment where you're like, someone just asked me a question that wasn't on the test. And, like, you're like, what do you mean the Holy Roman Empire? There's neither Holy nor Roman nor an empire. What does this mean? And so it's an old joke, old SNL joke, if you guys didn't get that. And I was like, it's your classroom. I don't know what your students need. Like, I'm like, this is going to sound dismissive, but I don't care. I'm like, and it's not because I don't care. It's just like, I don't have the ability to care about something like that because I'm not there. And I think that's the same way with reading a book. Like, do you hate the book? That's a valid feeling. Do you love the book? also a valid feeling, the one I would prefer. You know, like, whatever your feelings are on a piece of art, they're valid because they're your feelings. And you need to go find other people to express that with. Like, if you guys have never read any literary critique philosophy, I always talk about Roland Barthes because I found Roland Barthes late in my MFA career. And I read Death of an Author, and it was like, moment for me. Thank you for snapping. Because his whole premise is that once the author writes a work, they need to go away and die a metaphorical death so the reader can now engage with that work and inhabit that space. And I firmly believe that because I cannot rewrite it once it's printed. It's done. And there's nothing else I can do with it. I've said everything I wanted to say in my half of the conversation. You guys have to take the next part. And find people to talk about it with. Go yell about it on Goodreads. Send gifts to each other. Talk about ships that I'm going to inevitably sink. Because if you guys do not know what ships are, they're like relationships when you like hook up characters. And everybody uses ships that you tell them, like, this is my ship. I'm like, that's not going to happen. But I appreciate that you're excited that the thing is not going to happen. You should go write fan fiction because I can tell you right now it's not going to happen. So, yeah. I do like to completely derail you.
No.
Now you're thinking about all your sunken ships, aren't you? You're like, oh.
Checking off all of the questions you've pre-answered.
I know. I'm such a long talker.
No. I love it. I love it. When you wrote Dread Nation, did you know that you were going to talk? I mean, in there, there's police brutality, there's colonialism, there's white guilt, there's, you know, racism, there's misogynoir. There's all this stuff. When you read it and then you step back and then you look at all of the thematic elements, how much of that was intentional? I mean, I know you're a pantser, but how much of that did you sit down and go, like, I want to make sure I hit these things? And how much just kind of, like, surprised you in the end?
So I wrote Dread Nation before Trump got elected, and I did my last round of revisions, and it was, like, mostly just, like, line edits after he had gotten elected. And at that point, my editor was like, hey, have you looked at the things you baked into this story that are now true? And also how terrible for you, you awful future teller. And the thing is like, I'm writing from a historical perspective, right? Like the book is set in 1880. It's, the premise, if you are not familiar with it, the Battle of Gettysburg ends in the zombie apocalypse. And so the Civil War ends, but not really like with like the surrender at Appomattox. It's just, there's zombies, and oh shit, we need to kill them instead. And so nothing's really changed. Kind of how the Civil War ended anyway, right? We had a few years of Reconstruction, and then you have the corrupt bargain with Rutherford B. Hayes. And
a moment in the sun.
Yeah. And then everything slides right back, and then we get Jim Crow at the turn of the century. And so as I was writing the book, I was writing from a purely historical point of view. Like, keep in mind, like, so I am... I talked about earlier, like, I like tests, but I also didn't talk about I don't like finishing things. I'm a great starter of things. I have started 5 different master's degrees, and I'm amazing at it. And then 2 semesters in, I'm like, this is awful. I don't want to do this. Internet security. Who's going to use that? that was my option. That was my, that was 2002, and I was like, oh, I should have finished that one. But anyway, yeah, so like I had done a master's in history. I did everything for a master's in history. And Dread Nation was my thesis. I was going to write a thesis. I was going to write about the concurrence of education between Native American children at the time and Black children at the time and how basically almost the same systems were used for very different effects, right? Mostly because... former slaves did not have a cultural touchstone to go back to, whereas children taken from tribes did. And so you can't use the same kind of like assimilation and annihilation of the self that you can within. You know, like we love our HBCUs, but they were not always great. And so as I was writing this thesis and I was going through all this historical stuff, I kind of got overwhelmed because you're like, oh, everything's awful. But then you realize it's the same kind of awful we see today. And when I went back and made it fiction because zombies make everything better, I realized that a lot of stuff was already there. Like, I was not cognizant of putting the stuff in as I was writing because you can't. I mean, you're just trying to get through the scene, man. Like, you're just like, okay, I just need to get these people on a train and send them west. How do I do that quickest way possible? And you're just trying to get to that turning point to the next act. And then when I went back through in that last final walkthrough, I was like, nobody's going to want to read this book because it's so much. People aren't going to be willing to hear this truth. That was really my fear, because I baked in, 35, 30 some years of being a black woman in America, through a historical lens. And like, the conversations that are happening in the book are conversations I've been part of. They're conversations friends have told me about. And keep in mind, I wrote this book after my publisher had dropped me for my first two books not being successful. The first two books that they did nothing to market. And, I was very bitter. I was bitter, so bitter. Still bitter. But I'm, like, happy and then bitter, I'm more like an IPA now than, like, black coffee. I'm like, there's something good coming around the bend, right? Oh, you're a little bitter now, but just wait for it. And so I think that's, like, kind of one of those things, like, when you start telling your truth. This is why we need storytellers from different backgrounds, and we need a multitude of storytellers, because when you start telling the truth from a place of experience and your own emotional kind of trauma, right? Because like the story of Black America is a story of generational trauma. The story of Native Americans in America is a story of intergenerational trauma. This is why, if you've heard this hope punk thing that people are talking about, pisses me off so much, because the only time you can talk about hope punk and talk about like the fight is always the fight is if you've never been in the fight. Because anybody who has grandparents or great grandparents or aunties or uncles knows the fight's been going on forever, and it's going to still be going on.
500 some years.
Yeah, right.
I'm tired of hope.
Let a bitch rest. I think that's one of the things. It's like this idea that just because it's bad and it's always be bad doesn't mean it can't get better. And that's really where I think I wanted to enter the conversation with Dread Nation. I wanted to say, hey, we can recognize the things around us, and maybe that means that we can't change a whole lot, but we can work on this little plot right here, right? Like, we can pick up that piece of trash on the street so that it doesn't look like awful in our neighborhood. We can, take this little bare patch of median and plant flowers or something. Like, we can just do little things to hopefully make our personal spaces better. And then if enough people do that, then things start to change. And that was really kind of where a lot of that stuff came from. It's just stuff that's always gone on. But we don't talk about it, right? Because your history books are written by people who have no vested interest in telling that story.
Well, slaves were just workers who came.
I know. They were immigrants. I almost died.
And they were workers, and things were not so bad.
If you're not familiar, there was a Macmillan or a Hute Mifflin Harcourt, like two big textbook producers in the United States, and they launch all their textbooks in Texas first because it has the largest number of schools, and so they do the biggest buy-in. And there was a new social studies book that said that enslaved Africans were migrant workers coming to the United States to work. I was like, no one wanted to plant your cotton. Like, no literally, one wanted to be here. Like,
they were literally described not as slaves, but as workers.
Migrant workers, yeah.
Awful. Actually, you were saying something really interesting when we were talking about, so you and I both grew up sort of in the Northern California-ish area. You were in the Sacramento area before you went down to San Bernardino, and I grew up in Napa. We were both kind of talking a little bit about military background. You joined the Army right after high school because that was the thing to do.
I did a semester at junior college, and then I realized this shit's expensive, and I went to
Army. Yes. Yeah. And definitely in the late 90s, early 2000s, if you don't know anything about California in that time, dot-com crisis, there wasn't a lot of money. The schools weren't taking any local kids from, like, freshman year. It was bad.
Yeah.
So a lot of the boys in my school went off to join the Navy in June of 2001.
Womp, womp.
Yes. Given what you just said about Dread Nation and what we were talking about back there, there's an interesting parallel. And one of my questions was going to be, how has your time in the Army impacted your writing, if at all? And one of the things I was just thinking about is how in Dread Nation, the black and brown children are sent off to fight the zombie apocalypse. That's what we do. And it's actually kind of a similar thing now in our military. Who gets recruited? I mean, poor white kids and the black and brown kids are the ones that get, shipped off.
Oh, yeah. Like, so after 9/11, this is one of the things people don't, they talk about it, but, like, we quickly forget it because everything's awful and everything's on fire. But after 9/11, there was a push to people who were undocumented immigrants, get them to join the military so they could, we'll give you citizenship, come join the military. And I was not in Iraq or Afghanistan because I understand how systems work, and I know how to work systems, so that I made sure I didn't get deployed there. But I went to Kosovo, which is in Eastern Europe, which is also not like a pleasure garden. Ain't great. And so while we were there, I was there with the California National Guard, and it was all Latinx kids, every single one of them. Most of them were undocumented who they joined the military to because they were told this is the right way to do things. And they're like, okay, we're going to do it the right way. And of course, you know, they joined and immediately got sent off somewhere, you know. And so, like, yeah, there is a parallel there. I know, like, every year the DOD does a census of the rates of minorities who join, and also documented household income before you join, to see where are we pulling our forces from. And it is no surprise that people of color overwhelmingly serve. Latinx and Black people serve at higher rates than anybody else, and just based on according to census numbers, right? So, like, if you say the United States is 16% Black, the military is, like, I think last count was, like, 22% Black, right? Now, that sounds like, okay, that's not a big difference, but when you realize that the United States Army military is only, like, 1% of the population, it's a huge difference. When I went, here's a cool story for you. So, at one point, I was like, hoo, hoo, rah, rah, go Army kind of thing. And, like, because I'm always a person who's like, if I'm going to be in this shitty situation, I'm going to make the best of the situation. I'm going to be the best at being this worst. And so I was promoted early inside of all my ranks. And then E5 is like the big jump because you're no longer junior enlisted. Now you're a non-commissioned officer, which sounds fancy. But it just means you can boss other people around. And I love bossing other people around.
Yay.
Yes. I'm going to make someone miserable. Just wait till I get back. And so you go away from this school. It's like 30 days, and you run through the woods, and you learn how to be a leader. And basically what you learn is, like, you can't lead without getting other people to want to follow you, so you just learn how to, like, make friends. And so we walk into the lady barracks, and so there's always – I mean, this is, like, keep in mind, this is, like, 2001, slightly before September 11. And, like, it's lady barracks, one barracks. There's five different barracks, right? One lady barracks. The other four are all dudes, right? This is the representation of women. And that barrack was all Black women. Every single person in there except for two people, my battle buddy, who I'd come through basic training with, and one other girl who was, like, from another unit. Everybody else was a Black woman. And I was like, oh, shit. This is amazing. So I had never been around that many Black women in my life. Never. Not even growing up. I grew up in a very white area.
Welcome to Central and Northern California.
Yeah, yes. And my battle buddy, who was from Reno, we had come through MEPS together. MEPS is where you're in process to go to the Army. We'd gone through basic training together. We went through language school together. I went to language school in Monterey. So we'd been together our entire military careers. Terrified. She's never seen so many Black people. And she's like, I think they're going to hate me. I'm like, why? Because you got white boobs? Like, nobody's going to care. They're in the shower showering their shit just like you're showering your stuff, right? Because you have open showers. And she was just, like, very, like, nervous. And I told her, I was like, now you know how I feel all the time, right? They would make jokes. We make comments about hair stuff, right? Because at the time, I was very vain in my 20s, and I used to go to, like, the salon every, like, 8 weeks and get my relaxer done and, like, get my roots touched up. And I'm like, oh, my kitchen's out of control. I gotta get it done. And now I have no hair. But, like, my hair was really long, and so, you know, one of the girls would be like, oh, girl, let me comb around your hair. I'm like, oh, thank you. And I get my hair braided, and my bad boy's like, because she'd never seen me, like, around other Black women, because I was in military intelligence. We didn't have a lot of Black women because, you know, even when I joined the Army, like, the recruiters were like, wouldn't you rather be supply? I was like, why do I want to order people's toilet paper? Wouldn't you rather be medical corps? I don't want to wipe asses. I know what they do. Like, no. And so, like, even then, it was just one of those things. And so I think it's, like, it's important to talk about, like, you know, who's serving and why they're serving, right? Like, when I was in the Army, and even to this day, a lot of your junior enlisted are there because they have families, right? Because they live in a town where there is no work. And, you know, they got married like they were supposed to, had kids, like everyone told them that you're supposed to, now they can't feed them, you know? So they go and they join the military. And then even in the military, they're still on food stamps, right? So, yeah, I think, like, when I was writing Dread Nation, I wanted to talk about this stuff. I have other books that I still want to talk about, you know, who serves and why they serve and why we expect that that's okay, right? Because we do. We tend to, like, well, thank you for your service. Bitch, pay my medical bills. Like, don't thank me. Pay me, right? So, yeah.
Is there a story that you want to write or that you had to put aside that you, because you've got, you know, Star Wars coming?
I have lots of stories. I have so many stories. But mostly I put them aside, not because I don't have time. That's one reason. But mostly because I'm not a good enough writer yet. There's one, it's an adult novel. It talks about, you know, kind of like talking about this military-industrial complex and the way we kind of throw soldiers away. I've been trying to write for like 3 years. And I have a draft, like, so I've gotten through to the other side at least once. But every single time I come back to the beginning, I'm like, it's not there yet. It's not right yet. But Dread Nation was the same way. It took me forever to finally put all those moving pieces together in a way that wasn't just like vignettes of cool shit happening. So, yeah.
That's cool. Faya. We got to talk about Faya a little bit because I love that magazine. If you don't know, Faya is a short fiction magazine, science speculative fiction, and it's all black authors?
Black everything.
Yes. And Justina was one of the co-editors for 2 years, just stepped down. Tell me a little bit about how you got involved in that. And I mean, I know why it's important, but why is something like that important, especially for short fiction?
So a couple years ago, Fireside Fiction, it's a speculative fiction magazine, did a survey of black writers. You know, and they did not code for whether you were African-based or Africa-based. And that's a whole giant continent, but we just talk about African writers like they're all from the same place, like Nigeria, South Africa, whatever, African writers. They didn't code for that, but what they found was only 2%, less than 2% of speculative fiction that had been published in short fiction was by anyone who identified as black, right? So keep in mind, that's like that's everybody, right? That's not just like the people who are, that's even like that one like white lady who's like, I feel like I'm black inside. It's like, okay, whatever, we'll count you. Like that's how bad it was, right? And so we have like the world, if you do not know, the world has gone away from Twitter and mostly everybody has a Slack, right? So Twitter is like where you go, you're like, oh yeah, I'm here. But then you like go talk your real shit on Slack because Twitter is not safe. And so we were talking about it and I was like, we should like, you know, Troy and, Fenderson who are, Fenderson, is another writer. Clark. Yeah. He's really
Tram Car. The Haunting of Tram Car 015. Yeah. If you have not read it, go buy it.
Yes. And Black God's Drums. If you read Dread Nation and you like Dread Nation, go read that. Cause I love that. Yeah. But so like, we're talking, and they had talked about they wanted to start a literary magazine, and I was like, look, we should do it. Look at this. We have to. And everyone's like, well. And, of course, I had just sold Dread Nation at the time, so I was like, look, boom, there's some money. We can start a website. We can start. And it's grassroots. Everybody volunteers their time. Everybody, like, the only thing, like, that little bit of money we started with, like, set up the website. It set up, it paid our artists that first year. It paid our authors the first year. And people responded because it's great writing. It's just, you can't, like, people don't want to read about blackness, right? And I don't say they don't want to read, but the people who are making decisions about what people want to read don't want to read that, right? Because they want to publish the same, like, stale Arthur C. Clarke shit that they've been publishing since the late 1940s. And I do mean all that disrespect to Arthur C. Clarke. He can go pound sand. And so it becomes this very stale, you know? And so by being a little more aggressive and by having like this grassroots kind of movement, we've been able to actually change stuff in other places, right? And I had to step down just because I can't do it. But they're doing, the magazine is so great, and it's such a deal. It's like $2.99 an issue, and you get some of the finest black speculative fiction that you're going to find. And it's just like there's so many authors who've come through the magazine who are now going on to do other amazing things. Same with the artists. There's so many great artists. I say we because I still want to like own part of it. But I'm like, be free, beautiful butterfly. but it was like a labor of love. And like I think sometimes great art comes just strictly from a labor of love. And so it was really nice to do that. I'm really grateful for the time I was allowed to spend there. And like, I just love that Troy and Devon are now kind of carrying it on and keeping it real, as the kids say.
Will you be writing any more short fiction?
Short fiction is so hard for me because I'm so verbose. In case you didn't catch that. But yeah, I have a couple, I have a short story for an anthology and other short fiction I'm working on. Usually short fiction ends up being like where it's where my book ideas that don't work go to crash and burn. I'm like, oh, whatever, short story you are now. There is an anthology coming out next year, I think. It's called Phoenix Must First Burn. Phoenix First Must Burn. It's an Octavia Butler quote. And it's speculative fiction all from black women and black non-binary people. And it's pretty awesome. So I do have a short story in there. But it's fun. It's not like sad or like moving. It's kind of like, let's go have an adventure with dragons.
Ooh, dragons.
I just wanted to write a dragon adventure.
You haven't written dragons yet?
I haven't. I love dragons so much too.
I've forgotten my last question.
I'm so sorry.
Actually, no, I remembered my question. Is it okay if we talk about your tattoos?
Yeah, I actually took my sweater off because I was dying. I was like so hot. I was like,
so your tattoos are more visible than mine. I got mine hidden. I was like buried in a conservative area for a while. So I got like, they're all, you know, under the clothes. But tell us a little bit about some of the ink you got here. What do you got?
Yeah, so I have like children's book shit. That's really, what did you have? What do you want? I want children's book shit. All right, we can do that. Yeah, so I have like the little Where the Wild Things Are, and then I have some Seuss characters. My daughter's name Madeline, so I have, of course, my little Madeline. And then I have Elephant and Picky from the Mo Willems books, because those are the books that saved my sanity as a young mother, because if I had to read Goodnight Moon, I was going to murder someone. The moon was going to die. Because, like, when you have a kid, the shit people give you is all the shit they liked when they were like... And you're like, you're 80, and no one wants to read this racist book. Like, ugh. Yeah, so, like, the Mo Willems, like, saved my sanity. When I discovered the Elephant Piggy books, I was like, thank you. And we had just, like, we used to go to those. Every time my kid would be like, let's read. I'm like, no, how about, this is not my hat. That's also a book that drives me crazy for some reason. I don't know. It's because it's murder, and, like, everyone pretends it's, like, so sweet, right? It's a children's murder book, and, like, people are like, it's so, I was like, if a woman had written a children's murder book, you guys would have crucified her on the internet. And, but like, they're like, he's so insightful and sensitive. I'm like, it's murder. The big fish is going to murder the little fish. But yeah, so it's just, I love children's books. I love books. I like books. I think children's books are important because they give our kids and they give us a foundation for how to talk about the world, which is why it's so important that they have like, you know, good, diverse, you know, content and not just like the same talking aardvarks that we've seen for 100 years.
We're going to throw it to audience in just a moment, so think about your questions. I don't know if there's are there mics going to go around? Yes, there'll be mics going around. So if you have a question, but I wanted to ask you one last thing.
Yes.
Excellent.
Oh, yeah, there's a little microphone.
Yes, if you have a question, you can line up. And I hope you do have questions because we still have another 15 minutes.
I'm so sorry. I was like, no,
I've got more. I can start talking about sliding glass doors, and windows and mirrors. I can pull out all kinds of library and shit. I want to ask you what you're reading right now.
Oh, shit. What am I reading? I'm like feast or famine now because like when I have to like do, I'm like, no reading. And like, it's at the end of semester. Like somehow my school ends the semester after everyone's done. And I'm just like, why are we still going? Like my students are like, why are we still here? I'm like, I don't know. Nobody wants to be here. Turn in your final projects. Let's like not come to school anymore. So I actually have been only reading, I haven't read anything. I mean,
the last thing you read that you really enjoyed.
The last thing I read was a graphic novel. I love graphic novels because they let my brain kind of clear out. So I always get the sagas when they come out, the trades. I usually get the individual issues, but then we got to like 100 and whatever we're on, and I was like, This is not okay. Like, I have these boxes of comics that, like, follow us around. And he's like, it's taking over the living room. And, like, my cat, like, jumps in the box and knocks half the comics out. And he's like, we can't live like this. We're adults. And I was like, but they're comics. So, like, I get the trades now. And I like Wicked and Divine. I get the trades of those. But I read a graphic novel called Check Please, which is about like these hockey kids. Yeah. But like, where are my girls? Like, where are my girls who love girls graphic novels? Like, we like I know like
on a Sunbeam. Although it's webcomic still.
Yeah.
But.
I have Spinning. I have Spinning on my shelf. And I have like strong female protagonists on my shelf. Those are like my big ones. They're so big. I'm like, I have to get back to you later. Like, what else have I read? I swear I read books. Oh, the last book I really enjoyed I read was Circe by Madeline Miller, which I think is a strong contender as a young adult book that they just decided to market as adult because there's sex. And towards the end, her journey is a little more grown up and a little more complex, I think, than we see. But I think it could have easily been a young adult book. So I'm always interested in the books that get thrown over to young adult and the books that get thrown over to adult for their literary content, because I have a deep and abiding hate for the idea of literary as some sort of faux echelon of storytelling when you can have commercial fiction that's just as compelling.
Yeah. Yes. You're welcome.
Thanks for coming to my TED Talk.
Yeah. No, it's so true. There's been a couple of books where I'm reading this. I was like, this was clearly a YA book that the publisher decided to jack up as adult because they didn't think they could sell it as YA. And I'm like, just sell it as YA. You'd be fine.
I've read some YA books that are the opposite. I was like, oh, get this to the literary people. Get this out of my camp.
Yeah. Well, there's that interesting discussion, too, of what authors get called YA, despite the fact that the book is not YA. I will fight until the day I die every single person who argues that Trail of Lightning is YA, because I'm like, no!
Yeah, no, that's not YA.
But you get into that where they're like, oh, yeah. Well, it's a woman author and it's a woman character, so it has to be YA. I'm like,
I have a really compelling idea about the difference between YA and adult fiction. It's basically about the storytelling structure and the community building versus the hero's journey. But we don't have time for that. And that's like a 2-day lecture I give to my class. But anyway, the hero's journey ruins everything for everyone. There you go. The end.
Do we have any questions from the audience? Come on up. Line up.
Oh, you get to be like, okay. I was going to say you get to be like real close. I'm like grilling.
Actually, I want to pause real quick and just remind people that please make them questions. As much as I love your thoughts and opinions,
if you come up here with a statement, I will tell you. Justina will be
signing later, and you can pass on your many long comments later. So questions.
Yeah. Hi. First, I want to say thanks for coming.
Thanks for
speaking
having.
With us. I appreciate it. I did buy a copy of your book.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to reading it. But my question for you is this: when you sit down and you write, I'm sorry I was a little late, so.
Okay.
Forgive me if you already answered this, but do you free write or do you outline?
Oh no, I free write. I free write. I hate outlining. I can outline. So here's the thing. A lot of people say you should free write, not outline. A lot of people are like, you should outline. You should never free write. You should do whatever works for you. And for what works for me is crying, right? So I sit down and I have a good long cry. And then I eat something that's not good for me. Usually a pastry, because I love pastries. And then I just sit down and write it. It's work. It's like anything else. It's like gardening or, I don't know, child tending. I don't know. Do people tend children? I guess whatever you do with your child, gardening your children. It's just work. You just have to get to it. And I think that's one of the things. There's no wrong way to write a book. As long as the end result is something near where you wanted it to be, you've succeeded. So, yeah. Thanks. Free write, outline, froutline, whatever. Yeah.
So I'd hide my press pass because these are personal questions.
Oh, yeah.
And also I have two. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Okay, so my first question is about craft. You're a pantser, and you make things up as you go along, but you're also writing in a historical period. So what happens when you get to the point where you're like, oh, I want to put them on a train, but I don't know exactly what a train would look like at this point? Do you just write and assume that if it's not correct, you'll fix it later? Or do you stop and then go do some research and then go back to the story?
So what time of day does this moment hit? Because if this moment's like 09:30, I'm like, oh, I'll just Google and open this bottle and I'll figure it out tomorrow. But if it's like 9 a.m. and it hits, then I usually just write. But keep in mind, I'm writing history with like zombies. So there's some creative license there, right? I don't have to be adhere strictly. One of the things, one of my favorite reviews whenever I see it, because I read my reviews because I'm that kind of thirsty bitch. I read a review where someone was like, there are so many historical anachronisms in this book. I was just completely taken out of the story every time I read one. I was like, there are zombies! There are zombies! I'm sorry senatorial elections did not occur that way in the real timeline, but there are zombies. I think allowances were made. And so that's really kind of what I did. Like, when it came to that stuff, like a lot of that technology stuff, I just made shit up because zombies, and I could take some creative license.
The other question, and I'm trying to think about how to phrase it without making it spoilery, is that, so I'm a middle school teacher. I read a lot of YA, and there are certain patterns that you start to recognize. So when I started your book, I started to be like, I feel like there might be a love triangle showing up here. And then I realized by the end of it, the most important relationship from my perspective, again, I'm the reader, I'm not the writer, was this friendship. And I was like, yes, I love this. Did you know that you were going to go towards that, like, friendship relationship?
That is a thing I did do on purpose. That is one thing. So in a lot of YA, there's this, always this setup of a love triangle. And look, love triangles are valid. There are people who love them. I do not. And I don't like them because the reality is girls usually don't get that much choice in their lives, right? Like, there's a lot of pressure and there's a lot of outside forces that make us choose who we're with, however you want to read that. And so, like, love triangles, I think, give a faux idea of choice. Plus, there's no really good way to build in a queer love triangle, especially if you have a bisexual main character, because then it's like, she's choosing queerness. No, she's choosing heteronormativity. And so there's always like this. So like, when I sat down and wrote the book, I was like, I don't want to write any romance. And the reason I did that is because I suck at writing romance. You have to keep in mind, like, I've been married, I will be married 20 years at the end of this month, okay? I got married when I was 20, very young. Now you know I'm 40. And so, because that's how math works. But one of the things that happened is, like, my marriage proposal was, we were driving up the hill after getting Subway, and my then friend with benefit was like, hey, we should get married. And I was like, why would we get married? And he's like, I don't know, we can live off post. And I was like, that sounds like a sweet deal. Yeah, we should get married. And that is how I got married. So, like, romance is not my jams, right? Like, my husband, I always tell the story that one time I asked my husband, I'm like, can't you buy me flowers? He's like, okay, I'll buy you flowers. He came home with a funeral bouquet. Like, purple mums. I'm like, who the fuck gives purple mums? I was like, didn't it have, like roses are classic? He's like, yeah, but you like purple. I'm like, they have purple roses. He's like, I don't know, they weren't in the case. These are right at the front. I was like, so I never ask him for, like, flowers anymore, and I give him explicit lists of instructions when he goes to the grocery store. But all that to say, yeah, I do think there's sometimes when you're writing in YA, it's helpful to know the tropes, which is why I always, my advice to everybody who's like, I want to write a book, I'm like, read, and then read some more. And especially in the area of fiction that you think you want to write in. So if you want to write literary contemporary, I mean, good on you, but also read deep. I know there's so many literary writers here. They're just like, they're going to see my tweets and like come find me in the green room. Like, you're wrong. I'm like, I have an MFA. I know I'm right. And so the other thing is when you can engage in those tropes meaningfully, you can lead people on the wrong trail. And I love leading readers astray. Sometimes wrongly, though, because then people get mad. They're like, oh, I thought there was going to be a love triangle. And I'm like, oh, sorry about your luck. But you learned a valuable lesson on the way. It was the friends we made. And so, yeah. So
literally.
I did. Yeah, literally. Literally, that's the theme of the book. But yeah, I did want to do that. I also think in my adolescent life, my friendships were much more important than any romantic relationships I had. And even as an adult, my romantic relationship started as a friendship. I've been married for a very long time. I tend to think that's the way to go. I think it's important to talk about, like, you know, look at these tropes and look at what we're telling, especially girls, because, I mean, we tell boys a lot of things too, but girls have a much harder time of it. They tend to be exploited in a way boys aren't, and especially when it comes to relationships. So, yeah.
Well, and there's also that side of if there's ever two girls in a YA book, generally speaking, they're competitors. They don't get to be friends. And I really appreciated the. I mean, they're competitors too, but they, you know, become friends.
Yeah,
and
I hate that she's not like other girls thing, because that was one of the things people kept telling. They were like, "Oh, Jane, I love Jane because she's like so one of a kind." I'm like, she goes to a school with 100 other girls just like her. Like, she's literally not one of a kind. She's just, and she's mouthy, and she has a personality, but she is not the only. And that's one of the things I wanted to, like, hit a little harder in the second book, because I think a lot of people missed that. Like, there are lots of girls like Jane out there. There are lots of Janes, and there's, you know, there are lots of Janes in our world now.
We have time for one more question, if anybody has one.
Anything.
Oh, come on, people. I know it's like noon.
You've been so patient. It's like lunchtime. I'm thinking about tacos.
Here we go.
Do you know where there are good tacos? Are you going to tell me where there's a good taco place around here?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
there's one called Flacco's, and I was like, that's like skinny person. I'm not going to eat skinny people's tacos.
No. Well,
so I automatically crossed that one off the list, so don't give me that one.
It's, you know, I don't remember the name. It's on Telegraph, though.
Okay.
I'm going to give my book signed. I'll describe where it is.
Thank you.
Okay. I think the thing I love most about Dread Nation was the conversation or subtext about shadism. And do you get asked a lot about that, or do people bring that up a lot?
People because hate that so much.
Oh, it was one of my questions on here.
The colorism conversation. People,
I loved it.
There's no winning the colorism conversation because the colorism conversation is really about white supremacy, and white supremacy kills us all. Like, nobody wins white supremacy, right? People think they're winning in the short term, and then they show up with their boohoo BuzzFeed article and in 5 years, right? Oh, white supremacy. Nobody likes me anymore. It's like, 'cause you're an asshole. 'Cause white supremacy makes you an asshole. I obviously am not a very dark. I'm biracial. But I think there's a lot of conversations we have about the benefits of being lighter skinned, but we never talk about what that means intra-community when you're lighter and the perspectives from people who are darker. And that idea that, well, you're somehow better off. And it's like, no, I'm not better off because we're all being screwed by white supremacy. And like, you know, because it's a little less bad for me doesn't mean it's not bad. And I think that's one of the things, like, if it's bad, bad is bad. A lot of people do not like that conversation. And it's one of the things that's like, there's always those regrets. You're like, man, I wish I could have landed that better. And that's one of the things. Cause I did want to make that conversation about like, just cause, you know, lighter, you're still part of, if you're still part of a community, you're still experiencing that in a different way, maybe, but your experience is still valid. Cause that's really where I wanted to come from, is everybody's experience is valid. Like, we can talk about, like, if somebody wants to talk about how colorism impacts them, I'm not going to say like, you're wrong. Cause it's a true statement. Like, if you're like, you know, if I were light skinned, I feel like my life would be better. I'm like, conversely, maybe not. Maybe we need to like think about overthrowing white supremacy as a whole. Maybe we just burn it down and start again. Right. Like, that would be great. So I did engage some of that. And then I think some of the stuff in there is like, you know, like Sue is my favorite character. Like, people are like, who's your favorite character? And like, she's such a great character, and she comes back in the second book. But like, I mean, I'm gonna give you a little bit of spoiler. She's truly the only person who like understands the systems around her and just kind of plods through. Like, she is just like, and like, she doesn't get a lot of screen time just because of how things got restructured and edits, but she's in the second book. And like, I think, you know, a lot of people were like, well, she's dark and oh, she must be big and dumb. I'm like, no, she's big and she's strong. And that's an asset in this world, right? This is not, these are not girls who are like trying to be pretty, right? These are girls who are trying to be useful and murderous and like, you know, survive. And sometimes surviving looks a little different from us. So yeah, like, I do think colorism is an important conversation. But maybe like, I'm just not the person to have that conversation, and that's fine.
I think you did a pretty good job.
Thanks.
As
you're
a,
also
as a
light.
Very light skinned girl who passes a lot.
I think you did just fine. On that heavy duty note, it is 12:15. Thank you so much.
Yay.
Everybody, round of applause.
Thank you so much for your questions. I want to remind, Justina will be signing. Her books are out if you walk out and to the left. She's going to be signing on the sidewalk, so please block up traffic. It'll be great.
Yes.
Buy lots of books. We have no sponsors, but thank you to our magical sponsors of the whole thing, and thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.